Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. A new gaggle of lawmakers in Columbus is preparing to tackle the looming multi-billion dollar state budget deficit. Freshman Republican House member Bob Peterson of Fayette County says he is ready for the challenge.
I've served 14 years as a county commissioner, and I recognize very quickly that you can't satisfy everybody and you shouldn't try. You should do your homework, do your research, and do what's best for the state of Ohio. And that won't please everybody, but what's important is that you get it right for the long term, not necessarily what's politically expedient.
And then again, what about changing the equation altogether? Balancing Ohio's budget will require some tough choices. But what about changing the choices altogether? To that end, a coalition of nine Ohio-based metropolitan chambers of commerce have collaborated on a plan that reimagines how the state of Ohio operates to improve its economic performance and reduce overall costs. For more information on that study and report, go to the link we posted on our web at wosu.org/allsides. The new report is called Redesigning Ohio, and we've invited the authors of the report to talk about it. David Osborne is a senior partner of Public Strategies Group and the author of five books on public finance budgeting. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Greg Browning is a former state budget director under Governor George Voinovich in the 1990s and now is president of Capital Partners, an Ohio-based public policy and management advisory firm. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be with you.
David, in your books and in this report, you endorse a strategy called budgeting for outcomes, paying for results instead of funding programs. How does that work in a two-year budget cycle?
Well, what you do is essentially the state's leaders, whether the governor is – usually the governor leads this, but a legislature could. But the leaders decide how much money are we going to have to spend and what outcomes, what long-term results do the citizens most care about? And they do that through surveys and focus groups. And those, there's no mystery to those. They're things like better education and better health and better transportation and better a better environment and better jobs, a better economy, et cetera. Then they decide how much, what is the relative importance of each of those? How much of our money should we be spending to achieve each of those outcomes? And once they've done that, they've got a pot of money, a finite pot of money devoted to each outcome, to better education, to better health, to a better environment. And then they make the agencies compete to get that money by making offers for how they can do more with less, how they can innovate, how they can use cutting-edge ideas to produce better results with less money. And when those offers come in, there's a team that ranks them for each outcome. They rank every program offer from most cost-effective to least. And then they start buying from the top. And, you know, at a certain point, their money runs out, and programs below the line are not recommended for funding. And we've learned in the – we've done this with, about 20 different jurisdictions, states, counties, cities, even some school districts. And we've learned that it's wise to send those first rankings out, because that's when a lot of the managers suddenly take this very seriously and begin really looking for innovations, when they see that their program is below the line or even just above the line, and someone else might leapfrog them in the next round. So final offers come in, they're ranked again, they go to the governor and his team, and they make the final decisions. But you put together a budget organized not by department, but by the results citizens want. And you show those citizens, here are the programs we can afford in the next biennium to achieve those results. Here's the line, and here's what we can't afford any longer, because they're not as cost-effective. They don't give us as much bang for the buck as these others.
Well, that's the rub. Here's what we cannot afford, and that's where feelings get hurt.
Absolutely.
Greg, when you were state budget director throughout much of the 1990s, Governor Voinovich talked about working harder and smarter and doing more with less, and also about changing the paradigm of state government. And I was wondering how this proposal compares to that ambition or those ambitions.
Well, it's consistent. I think we took baby steps in the direction that David is talking about in meaningful ways. But this, in many ways, turns traditional budgeting on its head. Instead of starting out with the status quo or 90% thereof, you start out with a focus on results that matter most and the best means of reaching those goals. And it's something that I think we believe is consistent with growing desire on the part of taxpayers, citizens, voters, and others to get the best bang for the buck on what matters most. So it rationalizes the process in that direction.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about a new report. It's called Redesigning Ohio. We've invited the authors of the report to talk about it. David Osborne is a senior partner of Public Strategies Group and the author of five books on public finance budgeting. Also, Greg Browning, former state budget director under Governor George Voinovich in the 1990s and now president of Capital Partners, an Ohio-based public policy and management advisory firm. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and have some questions about this. Again, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides if you want to get some more information about the report. A major component of the plan calls for charter agencies. This has worked fairly well in Iowa, you wrote. How would it work differently in Ohio, where there's a much larger population, much larger, much bigger cities with bigger city problems and kind of more of everything here than Iowa?
Well, it would work differently by getting you more savings than it got in Iowa. Iowa's a small state. We did it with six agencies there out of about 30. They delivered over $90 million of savings to the taxpayers in the first 3 years. It's a real simple concept, and in fact, it's the way most of government at every level should be managed. You have to understand that the biggest cause of inefficiency in government is that there are too many rules, you know, too much red tape. So the idea here is let's give managers of departments that have proven that they're pretty good, let's give them more flexibility. Let's let them waive rules, some of the rules, not all, but some of the rules that make it difficult for them to produce results and that force them to waste money. Let's waive those rules, and let's let them manage in a more rational, business-like way. And it's that simple. In return for that, you give them less money. A lot of managers will take that deal because they understand that they could deliver better results with 5% less money if they could just, you know, get rid of some of these silly rules that force them to do wasteful things.
Some of those rules perhaps have to do with unionization of the workforce, and I was wondering if the charter concept can work with a unionized workforce, the likes
Absolutely.
Of which we have in Ohio.
Absolutely. Iowa was unionized, and the governor was a Democrat, Tom Vilsack. The labor was part of his base. He did nothing in 8 years to cross labor. Most of these rules aren't about unions. These rules are about how it takes you 6 months to buy something. Because the procurement system has so many rules, because we don't want anybody to steal anything.
Right, and those procurement rules were established over time for good reason, because of fraud.
They were, and now we live in a different age. Now we live in an information age where you can set up a procurement system that's electronic, that's online, and that is much, much faster, much, much more efficient, and 80% of those rules are now dinosaurs. They're antiquated, and all they do is produce waste. I mean, Greg lived through this for 8 years. Ask him about it.
Right. I think, Ann, that what we're really talking about in many ways is empowering employees. We have many talented people working in state and local government in Ohio who know what we're talking about even more than we do. And freeing them up, and at the same time, and giving them the tools to get the job done is a important advancement, and at the same time, more accountability relative to results. So we free up process and empower employees, and at the same time, buy better results and hopefully at a lower price. It's really about bringing productivity improvement to the public sector in meaningful ways.
You talk about the idea of entrepreneurial management, getting more bang for the buck by forcing agencies to earn revenue by selling their services to other agencies. When agencies start to devote a portion of their collective energy to competing with each other, doesn't that sort of take away from their core mission? Like, if you're in the business of human services, what sort of revenue could you earn selling services to other agencies?
And this is only a small minority of agencies that we're talking about here. These are agencies that actually don't serve the public. They provide services to other agencies.
Okay. Like,
example,
administrative services?
Yes.
Okay.
Like printing or vehicle maintenance. So you take a vehicle maintenance shop. The way it's done traditionally, I'm not sure how it's done now in Ohio, but traditionally you set up a monopoly. It's all public employees, and all managers have to send their vehicles there for their maintenance. Well, it turns out that monopolies aren't the most efficient way to do things. And many places around the world, this is not a new idea, many places around the world over the last 25 years have figured out that if they actually take the appropriation away from that vehicle maintenance shop and give, say, 90% or 80% of it to the customers, the other agencies, and say, and then say to those customers, you know, you can take your cars wherever you want. If you prefer Jiffy Lube, take them to Jiffy Lube.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden that public agency knows that to earn its money, to earn any income, it has to compete. And you'd be amazed at how fast they get better and cheaper. It's that simple, and it's only a small handful of administrative agencies that we're talking about.
Greg, from your experience with Ohio State government, you know, as David just said, not all agencies would necessarily qualify for this kind of a role, but you wrote that the state should begin with agencies that they trust are ready to handle more operational freedom. And I was wondering, any ideas about which those would be, perhaps those most directly controlled by the governor? I mean, what would that require, another study to figure those out, or do you know?
No, I think we're talking about the general government agencies. Department of Administrative Services would be a leading example. And again, I think public employees in Ohio know what we're talking about, have made some steps. Certainly the notion of state printing and mm-hmm. contracting out and bringing a more competitive dynamic to the process has been going on in state government. So we are not starting at ground zero here in Ohio. We've got some processes in place that are consistent with what we're talking about. But we're talking about really institutionalizing this in more substantial and comprehensive ways, so it becomes a traditional way of doing business and not the exception to the rule.
We're going to have to take a quick break. We are talking about a new report. It's called Redesigning Ohio. It is the product of a year of research by 9 chambers of commerce in Ohio. It's a collaboration between them. They are recommending operational changes they hope will help the state improve economic performance and reduce overall costs. My guests are the authors of that report, David Osborne of Public Strategies Group, where he's a senior partner, and Greg Browning, president of Capital Partners, and also former Ohio Office of Budget and Management Director, in short, known as the Budget Director of Ohio. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
All Sides with Ann Fisher and NPR's Talk of the Nation discuss the issues you are talking about every day.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org.
Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org.
Now you can join All Sides and Talk of the Nation on the new 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Listen on 89.7 FM and streaming at wosu.org.
Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. 30 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. A chance of a little bit of afternoon snow, cloudy skies, a high of 33 degrees. There's also a chance of a little snow overnight tonight, a low of 17. A slight chance of morning snow showers for Friday and a high of 24 degrees. And as we look ahead to Saturday, there's about a 40% chance of snow and a high of 25. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about a report, the result of a collaboration between 9 Ohio-based metropolitan chambers of commerce. It's been proffered to the governor and the legislature as they begin to work on the upcoming biennial budget. My guests are David Osborne, he's senior partner of Public Strategies Group, and Greg Browning. He is president of Capital Partners. He's also a former state budget director in Ohio. They wrote the story. You have, I don't think, David or Greg, you two are in the position to comment on what the reaction has been or not. Any feedback?
I mean, on the ground in Ohio,
yeah.
So far, I think it's been positive. It has been received some editorial support among major dailies in Ohio, and beyond that, conversations, discussions, and formally it appears that it is being well received as a serious contribution. I don't think anyone has signed up for every idea, but that's, of course, not the primary focus here. It's to provide an analysis perspective that is reality-based, we believe, rational, and well worth serious consideration. And that's so far what we're getting.
You suggest that the recommendations be adapted in stages. What could be done quickly? What stage? Is there a stage that could be implemented immediately to reduce the deficit in this budget process?
Right. I think one thing, just in terms of context, I know many people know this, but we have a historically significant budget deficit projected in Ohio. There's approximately over 15 cents on the dollar is disappearing from the state budget. And our sense is that if we simply cut the status quo, keep all the agencies, reduce them by double-digit percentages, we will not be advancing. We may be balancing the budget, but we will not be improving services to Ohioans that are essential in the minds of most. And so redesigning is a good idea, in our judgment, if we had a well-balanced budget. In many ways, as David has pointed out, when you have a fiscal crisis that is permanent, or as a practical matter permanent,
right,
across the country, the need to redesign doesn't go down, it goes up. And so if we don't simply cut, will we simply create walking wounded divisions? Productivity goes down, service quality goes down, scope goes down, and we have a bigger set of problems at a point in time in history when we really need a stronger public sector, stronger public partner working with society, and not a weaker one. So to the extent you want to cut, we believe you also want to redesign. And so I think that context is an important part of the discussion.
David?
To address your question, I would say, you know, probably half of these 10 big recommendations could begin very soon, and the other half would be phased in over one or two biennia. The healthcare reforms, which are incredibly important because the state spends more than a third of its money on healthcare, and because rising healthcare costs are bankrupting local governments, schools, state government, and the private sector. You know, those are going to take some time. We're talking about a 3 to 5 year process, because we're advocating big reforms. But you look at tax expenditures. In the next few months, as the budget is put together, those tax expenditures can be reviewed, and any that are not producing bang for the buck can be eliminated from the budget. So some of it can happen real quickly, and then some of it will take a little more time.
We welcome calls and emails, Facebook posts from our listeners. Give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can always find us on Facebook. We have an email from a listener. Do your guests really consider these rules to be silly, especially in light of the dispatches reporting that there were 186 instances in 2009 alone of businesses not complying with the terms of the special deals and abatements given them by the state? How do your guests propose to ensure accountability and honesty without these silly rules?
Look, not all rules are silly, of course, but the way government works is every time there's a problem, every time there's a scandal or a problem, we put in a slew of new rules. And every time the Republicans don't trust the Democrats, they put in rules to prevent the Democrats from doing what they want, and vice versa. So over time, we add more and more and more rules. You look at our civil service system, which is simply our personnel system for government. It's based on rules developed 100 years ago. And every few decades, we add more and more and more. And now we have a system in which managers can't hire who they want, they can't fire who they want, they can't reward who they want, they often can't discipline who they want. It's a system in which managers can't manage. So what we're saying simply is, hey, look, it's 2011,
And some of these rules are now out of date and counterproductive. Let's figure out which ones those are and waive them or eliminate them and let the managers manage, but let's hold them accountable for results. That's the combination. In bureaucracy, which was the model we used in government in the 20th century, basically you're accountable for following the rules and spending according to the line items, period. In 21st century government, you're accountable for producing results that have value to the citizens. And that's the big shift we're talking about here.
You give credit to Governor Strickland for improving Ohio's regulatory climate, but say that we need to go further. Where are the checks in the system to make sure that the purpose of said regulations are being met? I mean, as you said, the regulations aren't all bad. It looks like that you're asking the business community to self-regulate, and that'll save us a whole bunch of money.
I don't think – I mean, my sense is that we're saying if we work with the business community more directly, more proactively, engage them, communicate more effectively, we'll get better results. We're not suggesting that we're lowering standards in the process. In fact, the design change is to focus more intently on results and less on – checkmark approach to life where we're looking at every single rule and regulation and deciding what's making sense or not making sense. We're saying, wait a minute, we need to focus on results. We need to measure. We need to understand the value. We need to understand the cost benefit in much more substantial ways. And the result will be better regulation, better public protection, and not less so.
Can
I clarify two things? Mm-hmm. First of all, when I'm talking about silly rules, I'm not talking about regulations dealing with business. I'm talking about internal rules that
control what
bureaucrats do.
Yeah.
Second point, we are not advocating just deregulation. Okay? As a country, we've all learned painfully in the last 5 years that if we don't regulate the marketplace, bad things, really bad things happen. We all know that. But there are regulations that say you must dot this I and cross this T and have nothing to do with results. For example, the way we've regulated emissions from autos for decades is we say you've got to have a catalytic converter. Now, a catalytic converter may no longer be the most efficient way to get pollution out of emissions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we require. And what we're saying is let's shift again to a 21st century model, which is happening all over the world, believe me, where we say our regulatory system is designed to work more with business to get the results we want and allow businesses to innovate to produce those results.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are David Osborne. He's a senior partner with Public Strategies Group, and also Greg Browning. He's president of Capital Partners and also a former state budget director. We're talking about a new report that they wrote on behalf of 9 Ohio-based metropolitan chambers of commerce. If you want to learn more about that report, go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you to get more details. You also give credit to the new Ohio Shared Services Division and the Ohio Office of Budget Management, which works to consolidate support services such as expense reporting and reimbursement and other things. You say that and other improvement initiatives are well-intended but underfunded. So I wonder, why not start out by simply funding the existing initiatives like that?
Well, that's not inconsistent with what we're talking about, Ann. And we also should say that as we look at redesign, we are recommending that dollars be devoted to these efforts. In other words, doing them on the cheap, doing them after everything else is done won't work. Real dollars need to be devoted to redesign work. This is something the state government hasn't spent a lot of time and resources doing over the years. And we are recommending, for instance, that the State Innovation Fund be created and seeded with $20 to $40 million for starters. So building on progress is a good idea, but really targeting the results, required, and putting money behind the efforts is what we're talking about.
You're looking for some of these changes via legislation or executive order, and I was wondering, if it's executive order, would lawmakers necessarily have to comply? In other words, you'd have an executive order to change this, but lawmakers still could enact legislation that, and it could be signed by the governor eventually, I suppose, that would create new agencies or create new regulations and that sort of a thing. How does it operate into the future?
Well, you know, part of what we did in the report is lay out a kind of philosophy mm-hmm. of managing government, which has a lot to do with what we've been talking about, shifting from focusing on rules to focusing on results, shifting from monopoly to competition, defining who the customers are, asking them what they want, and making people, making government agencies accountable for delivering to the customer. Those kinds of principles, as time goes by and they become more and more ingrained, will help redirect future efforts. But, you know, what you're pointing out is that this change process is always two steps forward and one step back mm-hmm. at the best. And, of course, the legislature and the governor will do things that, from a management point of view, are counterproductive at times. All governors and all legislatures do, because, you know, they live in a political sea, and they're making a lot of decisions for political reasons, which often make good management tougher. But, you know, you fight the good fight, and this is an effort to lay out 10 big reforms that will save well over $1 billion in the next biennium and billions more in future biennia. So we can't ensure that nobody makes a bad move in the future.
In fact, we can ensure that they will.
Exactly.
Like herding snakes sometimes. The report also addresses Ohio's 3,700 local government entities. You say that the biggest driver of the state's growing tax burden isn't the state, but rather local government taxes. Doesn't changing that kind of authority, what are you talking about there, telling them that they can't tax anymore or limiting the tax rates or what, Greg?
Well, as you say, we have 3,700 political subdivisions.
Talk about herding snakes.
Villages, yeah. Townships, counties, cities, mm-hmm. villages, the broad expanse of local government. And much of this comes out of the 19th century. We have people who got on boats and escaped oppression and kings and queens and wanted local government that was very vibrant, strong, and responsive, and we created all these entities. We have a long history of local control inside of that. Certainly school boards would be a strong example of that. So all of this, in many ways, is very positive, democratic activity, and we're certainly not suggesting that we made many, many mistakes in the process. Having said that, the weight of local government in an information age that is really, again, rooted in a 19th century history is becoming more and more problematic, and we've got local political subdivisions not communicating, not taking advantage of big opportunities to collaborate, to share services, to lower expenses and improve outcomes for taxpayers and all citizens. And we're saying, listen, and we're not alone. As you probably know, there have been other reports and studies mm-hmm. in Ohio and across the nation making the same point. That we really need to step back and look at the design that we have and make judgments as to whether or not we ought to reform that. And we're not suggesting that someone come in from on high and start eliminating political subdivisions. But we are saying that we need a more rational, strategic approach to state-local relations and to state and local service delivery, and that that has to be front and center, particularly when we know that if you look at the cost of government in Ohio from a number of perspectives, the state relative state level cost is lower than the local cost when we look at Ohio compared to the rest of the national landscape. So it's time, we believe, to step back. And I think that we're reaching a tipping point with this budget crisis where this kind of thinking, which has been percolating for years, as mm-hmm. you know, is now coming to the fore. We may have reached a tipping point where people are willing to stand up and say, we need to have this conversation in a very serious way. And so that's what we're recommending that we do, have that conversation. We've come up with some concepts, some design ideas to create a relationship consistent with what David has said about charter agencies, really applying that those principles to the state-local relationship. And the state does revenue sharing. In many ways, it's a no-strings-attached revenue sharing. And we're saying, wait a minute, let's step back, talk about that relationship, reduce costs because of a budget crisis, but at the same time, what can we do to make it a more productive relationship and buy results with these state dollars and not just write checks?
So, and also create incentives for local governments to innovate and to share services. Take a little bit of the money that the state sends to local governments every year and say, you know, to get this part of it, you're going to have to show us some innovation. You're going to have to show us some shared services. You're going to have to show us some efficiencies. So use incentives, financial incentives, not orders, but incentives to get local government to particularly to share services, because as you know, there's all kinds of small towns that have their own police departments, their own fire departments, their own everything, and economically it doesn't make sense.
In the report, the civil service systems get a lot of attention. You refer to them as once an important protection for public employees. That's no longer important. Is that no longer important to protect public employees? Because I was thinking about this kind of paradigm shift you are talking about people looking for these efficiencies, trying to change the culture of state government, and sometimes people can get punished for trying to do that.
Yeah, we certainly wouldn't say that those protections are no longer important. We don't want to go back to a world in which politicians appoint their campaign workers and their nieces and nephews to key jobs in government because of who they are, not because of their skills.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to go back there. And so we need a civil service system. What we're saying is we have one designed really well for 1911, and we need one designed for 2011. Does it make more sense for employees to make more money every year just by staying alive, or should they actually have to produce some results to make more money next year? Should pay be only linked to longevity, or should it be linked to performance? Should managers be able to reward good employees? So on and so on. You know, let's bring government into the same century business is in, into 21st century personnel management.
Could that go in the other direction, though, too? Because, Greg, you know, and I'm sure, David, you know as well, that public employees, despite all the rhetoric, are not paid as much as their counterparts in the private sector. They typically aren't. Greg, I know you can make a lot more money than you did when you were state budget director. So does it go the other way, too, that you could end up making a lot more money as an employee for state government than you are now currently limited to on the step basis and that sort of thing?
I think what we're saying, again, consistent with empowering employees to get the job done in better, more productive ways, we're saying we need to have a market-based, fair market-based system of compensation for state and local employees. The complexity of the work is not going down. It's going up and, in many cases, way up. So there's a great need to attract and retain talented people up and down the line. And in order to do that in our society, we need a competitive system of compensation. And in order to understand what that means, we need to go out and do first-rate compensation studies mm-hmm. to really understand what's what, and we're recommending that. But we're, again, also recommending a market-based system, and that means change particularly as it relates to the redesign analysis that we have, where we say we have to have a more productive state and local government picture. And in order to do that, we need to have compensation studies, have fairness between the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, and then start paying people for results over and above that, where they're getting paid individually and increasingly as team members based on bonuses, merit-based. So you have competition, you have fairness and equity, but you also are paying people for performance in more significant ways.
We have to take a quick break. Unless you want to just finish that thought, Greg.
That's
okay,
it.
We got to take a quick break. We'll return. We'll talk about what the proposals are for the prison system, what they're talking about in terms of tax credits and exemptions and deductions and changes along those lines. So stay with us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm the one fighting, okay? Not you, not you, and not you. I know what I need.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Mark Wahlberg and director David O. Russell talk about their new film, The Fighter. It's based on the true story of boxer Mickey Ward and his family. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on 89.7 NPR News. Listen to local news from the award-winning WOSU News team and national news from NPR on the new 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to enjoy the best in classical music on the new Classical 101. Classical music all day, every day. It's all news on 89.7 NPR News and all classical on Classical 101. For more information and to stream our services online, visit WOSU.org. Currently 31 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a slight chance of some afternoon snow today. Otherwise, cloudy skies, a high right around 33 degrees. A chance of snow overnight, a low of 17. There's a slight chance of morning snow for Friday, a high of 24 degrees. Clouds for Friday night and a low of 15 degrees. Looking ahead to the weekend, a chance of snow showers on Saturday and a cold one with a high of 25. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about a new report. It's out. It's called Redesigning Ohio. We've invited the authors of the report to talk about it. David Osborne is senior partner of Public Strategies Group and the author of five books on public finance budgeting. Greg Browning is a former state budget director under Governor George Voinovich in the 1990s. He's now president of Capital Partners. It's an Ohio-based public policy and management advisory firm. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to talk to them. And Rod, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. You know, what I've heard so far sounds fairly good, but, you know, at the same time, you know, basically, well, you know, we've just, you know, dealt in generalities. You know, I note that, you know, one person, you know, is representing, you know, in a way kind of represents the Chamber of Commerce. He wrote, wrote the report that was sponsored by the Chamber, you know, Chambers of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And the other person is from a administration that was fairly conservative in its approach to the government. I'm wondering, you know, where's the other side represented? And
okay, these are both the authors of the report.
Okay,
Rod, so they're together.
All right.
Yeah.
And by the way, one of us is a Democrat, one of us is a Republican, and but this is a chamber report. This is these priorities were chosen by nine chambers of commerce. So let's be very clear: this is a chamber report.
And the chamber did want to be on the show, but I just wanted to focus on the report this hour, Rod. So
okay, one thing that I would point out too, you know, and you know, I was in a position with the state government where, you know, they trotted out performance. You know, performance is great. The trouble is that sometimes they cut corners. And I was in a situation where this happened.
Okay.
And
well, let's talk about that. What do you mean by performance? Thanks, Rod, for your call.
Okay.
What do you mean by those kind of things? Well, in fact, an email from a listener says the guests keep talking about using a budgetary process that ends up with policies and programs with the best results and that have the most value added. Do your guests only mean monetarily measurable results and value? Can mental health programs or environmental quality policies and programs be measured only in monetary dollars and cents?
No, of course not. Mm-hmm. Of course not. This is government. We're talking about results in terms of making an impact on citizens' lives primarily. So, you know, usually what you do, and this the caller is right, there have been lots of performance initiatives in lots of governments, and a lot of them have been done poorly because this is new and it's not easy in government. It's not even easy in the private sector. But it's easier because there you've got a financial bottom line and people are pretty clear about what the key results are that you want. But in government, you need to focus on measuring those mission-related results that have to do with positive impacts on citizens' lives, whether it's minimizing pollution or minimizing traffic deaths or educating students or, you know, the myriad of other things that governments do. You also need to measure financial things so that you can see whether you're getting efficiency. You need to measure customer satisfaction so you can see if the citizens actually are satisfied with what they're getting. So you use a balanced scorecard approach. That's sort of the shorthand that has developed over the years since a couple of Harvard Business School professors wrote a book about it. You include for a program that's making an offer in the budget process, you ask them to give you data on a variety of results, their mission, accomplishing their mission, their cost effectiveness, their efficiency, their customer satisfaction, that kind of range of data. And the more data you can get, the better. Now, this isn't, you know, Ohio may need some work before it can develop that kind of good data. It does some measurement already, but I'm sure it needs to be improved.
One aspect of the report addresses tax expenditures. That's the money that the state foregoes from tax credits, exemptions, and deductions. And they're another area of concern. Can you give me an example of one that probably has seen better days and that's no longer relevant that might be, you know, what you're talking about in terms of this review?
Well, and there are approximately 120, 122 tax expenditures. These are credits, exemptions, and deductions built into the tax code, which results in foregone revenue to the state of Ohio. There is a report produced every 2 years along with the new budget bill that outlines, simply lists those expenditures and exemptions, largely without comment and largely without any analysis. And what we're suggesting is that you step back and look at these tax expenditures on a regular basis and apply the principles that we've talked about on the spending side and the organizational side to the tax expenditures to see if we're really getting what we should be getting out of those expenditures. If there's an expenditure that is in place to encourage economic activity, are we getting more economic activity? You ask about specifics. They run up and down the line. You go out and buy a magazine at the newsstand, you pay the sales tax. If you buy it as a subscription, you don't. Well, why is that? I mean, are mm-hmm. we getting anything out of that? You know, there are many different examples. Many of them we would probably do a deep analysis, and most people would come to the conclusion that we should keep them. But the point is to apply this results-oriented, outcome-based management philosophy in the public sector to the tax expenditures. And I think the Chambers of Commerce felt that this was important, and it was also important that they not just shine a bright light on what others are doing, but they also shine a bright light on what they're participating in on the tax expenditure side. And so they're stepping up. I imagine one or two of the members might want to be scratching their heads about why the chambers are doing that, but they think it's completely consistent with this overall approach and an important dimension of the report.
you address the growing array of state agencies. The Commission on Aging became the Ohio Department of Aging. The Youth Services Commission became the Ohio Department of Youth Services, and veterans organizations morphed into a state veterans department. There's also the Drug and Alcohol Addiction Services Department. I mean, you're right, but just because they've grown into a state agency doesn't mean they're not needed, does it? Or what are you saying there?
That's right. I think the message, though, is that in
don't
Ohio,
make any more up.
No, well, so, in Ohio, we have added over the decades.
In recent decades.
Right. We continue to add, being responsive to what we perceive to be legitimate issues that deserve more attention, more focus, more capacity, and that, frankly, are politically positive. So shining a light on the state's commitment to drug and alcohol issues seems to have gained a lot of support. We created an agency. And we're not saying, and therefore it's a bad idea. What we are saying is let's step back and look at what we're doing and relative to the results we want. Just because we create an agency with the right name on it doesn't necessarily mean that it's improving the drug and alcohol picture. Mm-hmm. And again, this is not to be disparaging of that department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I brought that one up, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just an example. And mm-hmm. so it's you apply the same standards to a new program as you would to one that's been around for decades. And so, again, stepping back, we're not for consolidation for consolidation's sake. We would be, if we were for consolidation, we really didn't get into that, but if we were mm-hmm. for it, again, it would be rooted in the principles that we have tried to articulate that really bring us back to focusing on productivity improvement, thus lower costs and improve outcomes. And the means of reaching that goal should include competition. Because we have a public purpose doesn't necessarily mean we need to go out and hire more public employees to advance that cause.
We have an email from Drew in Worthington. He writes, I'm not sure modeling our state agencies after private industry is necessarily going to cure all ills. As a person who has worked in both the private and public sectors, I have actually seen far more inefficiency and waste in the private sector. We're constantly asked to just accept as fact the notion that the business community is far more efficient in all matters. Being able to hire and fire at will always sounds great to executives, not so much for their subordinates. It seems your guests believe the market is infallible.
I think that we don't agree with that approach, but we do. And it's interesting, I think, that the chambers of commerce are not coming forward and saying, we've got it all figured out on the private side, just do what we do. In many ways, they're saying there are many good things going on in the public sector that need to be improved upon with redesign, not with elimination, not with replacement, but with redesign. And that would you see that in the proposal for improving, redesigning the state pension system. Many might think that the business community would come forward and say, eliminate defined benefits and replace them with defined contributions because, of course, that's 80% of what's going on in the private sector. That's not what happened. So I think revitalizing the public sector by redesigning it is what we're all about.
But you are talking about.
Go ahead. Jump in here. Mm-hmm. We are not saying that we should run government departments like businesses. Okay? We are saying we can run them in a more business-like fashion. I've been dealing with this question for 20 years. The book that more of your readers would know of that I wrote, Reinventing Government. We knew that this was going to be the reaction to what we were arguing. And so in the introduction, we put a subhead that said, government cannot be run like a business. But that doesn't mean it can't be run better, with more of a focus on results and producing better results for less money. We know we can do those things.
Businesses are in the business to profit. Should government be in the business of profiting?
Not generally, mm-hmm. no. No, government is in the business of making people's lives better.
The report, let's talk about the prisons. You address prisons pretty extensively, not just prisons, really the whole criminal justice system in Ohio. And I covered plenty. I mean, I almost resented. I covered so many hearings when they wanted to do three strikes and you're out. And Greg, I think you were state budget director at the time and must have been wincing a little bit when you knew how much it would cost to keep so many people in prison for so long.
Again, our proposals are about better public safety, better results, better outcomes for everyone in the circle, prisoners, prison officials, the people who pay for it all. How do we get better results relative to public safety and to rehabilitation of prisoners? And so that's really the lens that we use to look at this issue with, and then step back and say, what's going on? We have a situation right now where we're putting thousands of people in prison who are, many would argue, including experts in the field, that it is the most expensive place to put someone. It's over $24,000 a year in Ohio to imprison someone in our state prison system.
Mm-hmm.
Should we put people in there who are nonviolent offenders, first-time offenders, people who have drug and alcohol problems, mental health problems? Should we automatically put them in state prison? Our answer is no. Now, how do we change that thoughtfully, carefully, and protect public safety? That's the focus that we took, and it really results, we believe, in lowering prison costs and having better oversight of people, more intervention, more help with drug and alcohol treatment, illiteracy issues, mental health issues, all of which, left unattended, bring people straight back to prison at extremely high costs.
You know, you talk about non-residential facilities would manage the nonviolent offenders, but I wonder, where would they sleep? How would they work? It's hard enough for ex-felons to get a job these days, to be out on work release and that sort of a thing.
This is already going on where we don't have much intervention, and people are released from prison on their own in many cases and disappear back into society with often negative results. So we're really talking about more intervention to help them succeed and less high-cost spending on the back end of prison incarceration. So we're talking about reallocating resources in many ways and lowering costs, improving benefits in the process. This is difficult work. We understand that, and it needs to be done very carefully with public safety at the root of it all.
And when you talk about – yeah, go ahead.
This is something that other states have done and are doing.
Right.
This is a national trend.
When you talk about reallocating, though, I just want to ask real quick because we're running out of time. Are you talking about maybe – giving some money back to the mental health community in this state, which took such a huge hit in the last budget cuts? How are they going to absorb?
That system needs to be part of this, succeeding at this. There's no doubt about it. And investing intelligently in mental health intervention is an essential part of the picture.
Okay.
And we've said specifically, let's see a shift where we can close a couple of prisons and move the money into, you know, better education, training, treatment services for mental health issues and other issues.
I want to thank my guests for joining us today. We've run out of time. David Osborne, senior partner at Public Strategies Group. David, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Greg Browning, he is a former state budget director and now president of Capital Partners. They are the co-authors of a new report. It's called Redesigning Ohio. It was put together under the auspices of a coalition of nine metropolitan chambers of commerce. You can learn more about it at WOSU.org/allsides. We have a link there for you. Thanks for joining us on our first broadcast on 89.7 NPR News. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.